Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick and Zach Covemaker. Is that how you pronounce it? No clips this week. They're illegal anyway, so. visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Critics Pod is a handle. Like us there. Follow us. Interact with us. The trailers are up there. Sean's reviews. Sean's even been reviewing trailers lately.
Yeah, you know, just a new thing to do.
Yeah, so, and we even talk about, like, kids' things, about Old Town Road and stuff. So it's all there.
Well,
on
I gotta do stuff, you know, kind of throw people off when I get to my 2,700 word written review of The Virgin Spring, comparing it to you know, Dante's you know, comedy.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. You're gonna pack them in.
That one's gonna be a huge hit. I gotta figure, you know, I'm going a little mainstream on that one.
Should sprinkle in some Fortnite gifs. Really reel them in.
You need to see that. What's his name? That movie I saw earlier this year, the Lars von Trier movie. Because that really goes after the Dante's.
Yeah.
Like almost too much. Not to spoil it for you, I may have. I guess, what am I forgetting? Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Alexa, Stitcher. Follow us there. Rate and review the show. We'll read your reviews on the air.
And let us know, like, on Facebook or something, if you're talking about us. We were named one of the 25 best podcasts of 2018 by a website that didn't even, we had no idea existed.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. And I'm really bad at, because I made that joke last time Josh was here. It was like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Where at the end of the show, I made fun of Meryl Streep because of Uncle Jeff,
right.
And then I mentioned he doesn't listen. That's like, literally, the last thing I said before I cut it off was he doesn't listen anymore. And he responded with, I do listen. 2 weeks later, I noticed he said that. So I'm not very good at social media.
Our social media game is on point. People still say that?
I don't know. I just turned 26. The youth is starting to just dissolve.
We're going to check with you every now and again to make sure we're saying things that people still say.
I don't know if I'm the right guy. I go out clenched fists when kids are out past 10 now. Like, I can't do it.
I think it comes back when you're like, whatever Sean's age is. If you read his Old Town Road.
Thank God.
I was like, maybe I'm not old enough yet to get this. Guest news or Patreon. IHateCritics.net/Patreon is the best way to help support the podcast. We also have the podcast merch tab that's on the website as well, along with PayPal if you want to support that way. Every now and then TeePublic does these random sales. I try to post them on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram when they happen. But this is being like 30% off all the merch. We had one on the 4th of July that I posted. So if you want the merch, wait for the holidays and whatnot. There's always there. And if you have ideas, I'm open for ideas to make more merch. It's just I'm not very good at, you know, you see how good I am at social media. Now I have to be a graphic designer too. I'm an accountant by day, so this is I'm doing my best. Speaking of doing their best,
yeah,
Disney.
If it gets creative as an accountant, you know, that's bad news.
I am kind of the one in charge of creative on the show outside of the actual content. Sean does that. Disney, The Little Mermaid, they've cast Ariel, and it's Halle Bailey. Is that her name?
Yeah, Halle Bailey.
And as a ginger, and I don't care. I mean, everybody seems to, maybe it's pretend.
Childhood
up in arms.
Ruined.
My biggest complaint with these Disney movies is that they're the exact same thing as the cartoons, and I kind of want something different. And This is a step in the right direction, at least.
That's a far better complaint than what these guys are complaining
about. Oh, yeah. I feel like we need to focus on, like, what Sebastian's going to look like. That's the real defining factor of this movie. I don't really care about the other stuff.
We're going to talk about it in a moment. There's a teaser for Mulan that just came out, and I got to say, I didn't hear one Eddie Murphy voice dragon in that whole teaser. My childhood is over!
I have some bad news for you. Mushu's not in that movie.
What?
Yeah.
Forget it then, man. I don't want anything to do with it. Disney's destroying our childhood.
Let's go flip cars.
Yeah, we keep going and seeing them, so I don't know. I mean, I liked Little Mermaid at the time. I'm open for a different... Hopefully it's a different interpretation. If it's just the same thing, I don't care who the actor is, I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear the same songs. Do new songs, kind of change the story up, make it a little different. Mm-hmm. And that's with all of these. That's what I would like to see. But Mulan, do we want to go on
while we're here? I mean, I saw somebody post on Twitter today, who recycles more, the American people or Disney?
Is there a difference?
This is, you know, it's a badass trailer. I mean, she looks pretty awesome in those fight scenes. I'm definitely interested in that. And that one's got so many cartoony elements that, you know, that they can leave out of this that can actually make this kind of a better story.
Yeah, that's cool. I remember watching the movie and loving it back in the day, but honestly, I don't remember a whole lot of the original. I kind of want to see some crazy stuff. Like, obviously, the Mushu stuff's left out, and apparently they're putting in some phoenix or something. I don't know. Allegedly, it's not going to talk, and there's not going to be music, so the other stuff's pretty much dead. I want to see some cool fight scenes and some cool set pieces and stuff, and I hope we get that.
I never saw the original Mulan, so I was kind of old enough to not really care about Disney anymore and not having young enough to have kids, so it was just kind of something that passed me by. So I don't care about this, but maybe it'll be cool. I didn't watch the trailer, so there's that. Knives Out.
Knives Out is kind of an Agatha Christie mystery shot through the prism of Rian Johnson, the director of Brick, and of course The Last Jedi, and of course that's all anybody wants to talk about this trailer's talking about is they just jump to, I hate The Last Jedi. And it's like, what does that have to do with the trailer for this movie? It's got nothing to do with it. Yeah, but I still hate it. So, what do you think of the trailer? I didn't even watch it. I liked the trailer. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm always a little bit suspicious of Daniel Craig, he's not bad.
Yeah, and then the whodunit movie, we've seen it a million times. That said, we've seen Star Wars a million times, and Rian Johnson went and did something totally different. I happen to think it's the best one they've ever done. I'm in the minority there. But that means I'd like to see what he has to do with the whodunit. I'm sure this is going to be somewhat different than every other one that's been done, especially murder mystery.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you. I love The Last Jedi. I want to see him get crazy with this. I want to see, like, him take the whole genre and just flip it on its head like he did with Star Wars. I can't wait to enjoy that movie.
That said, I found there was one moment of the trailer that was really kind of weird and awkward that I didn't quite understand. That's the end joke. What is this, CSI KFC? Like, I think we need context for that particular joke, because otherwise it sounds like it should be funny. Chris Evans delivers it like it should be funny, but lacking any kind of context, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Is he referring to Daniel Craig's stupid accent?
Yeah, I don't. You're right. I kind of just, I didn't really think about the context. I'm just like, they don't all land. But he looks pretty crazy in it, and that looks fun. And Toni Collette's always over the top and good. So, and Rian Johnson's not disappointed me yet. So, yeah. Then Jumanji, The Next Level.
Yeah, this was interesting because this is a really smart trailer for how they play the little mysteries within the movie. Like, first of all, the main character from the last movie, who was inside the rock the last time, is now gone missing this time. And what you don't see in the trailer is him ever actually going into the game, even though they assume he has. And then one of the other characters also has a similar thing where Brittany, she disappears as they're going in, and you don't know where she ends up. And then you've got Danny DeVito and Danny Glover put into these characters. And I'm a little worried about them overplaying like that old man shtick with The Rock and Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
Overall, I mean, it worked enough, and I really liked the way that they played the mysteries, those little elements. Like, there's a character played by Awkwafina in the trailer who, I mean, is that
right?
Is that the wolf character? Is that him in her, or is he like the Nick Jonas character now? Like, I mean, where you could be anywhere in that in terms of playable characters, and so that was interesting. And I dug the first one, so I'm in.
Yeah, same boat, man. Like, hearing Kevin Hart do a Danny Glover impression, like, boom, I'm in. The Rock is Danny DeVito. Yeah, this is me all over. Like, I can't wait.
I I did enjoy that, but at the same time, watching the first one, Kevin Hart was Kevin Hart, The Rock was The Rock. Only Jack Black kind of played to the kid. So me wanting consistency, that kind of bugs me, but at the same time, it's funny. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I shouldn't care. It's a popcorn summer movie, or Christmas movie, whatever it is, so it doesn't matter. But part of me is just like, just do it the way you're supposed to do it. Let's move on to Spider-Man Far From Home.
All right, Spider-Man Far From Home, picking up in the aftermath of Avengers Endgame. Most of the kids who went to school with Peter Parker were snapped out of existence and returned then at the end of Avengers Endgame, and Peter was, of course, among them. And now, 5 years down the road, they're back in school, and they're being sent to Europe for a class trip. Peter wants to leave the Spider-Man character behind for a little bit and try and just be a kid and try and get with MJ on this trip, and Nick Fury's not going to let that happen. He's going to interrupt him because there's a threat from a group called the Elementals, these giant monstrous things made of the elements. There's a superhero called Mysterio, Quentin Beck, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who is basically helping him out and kind of acting as if he's the new Iron Man in a way. Really fun, really exciting, and I do love Spider-Man. He's my favorite superhero. I like this movie a lot. I want to preface that. That said, I mean, this is one of those movies that the thread is just hanging there, and you just want to reach up and pull it. You just could pull it all day, because Quentin Beck's plan is so stupid. And so overcomplicated and so nearly impossible with the things that have to go right that I could tug on that thread and pull it and watch it fall to pieces. But I don't want to do that because I like Tom Holland and I like Spider-Man and I like Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. He's weird. He's chewing the scenery. He's over the top. It's great. I dig it. And so I like this Spider-Man, but I know that thread is just hanging there.
Yeah, and that's kind of what works best with that movie. Like, it's the most, like, comic book accurate Spider-Man movie ever, and it works. It works, but there's also, yeah, there's a lot of stupid shit in there. Like, there's a lot of stuff where you can be like, I get it, but, like, you just gloss over it because you're just having such a good time. It's awesome.
That bar scene is utter nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
It's just complete and utter nonsense. There's no way that works in that.
It's so unnecessary.
And that really bugged me afterwards. Not while I was watching it. While I was watching it, it was really super entertaining. But afterwards, I'm thinking about it, like, all the things that have to go right for these characters to end up where they end up is so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if he doesn't give him the glasses, now what? And at least you have a couple plans that fail, and yeah. Then, you know, do what you can to get there. I don't know. I fell asleep early on because I've been camping all weekend and I kept coming back home to let the dogs out and stuff and see Spider-Man. And I was sitting there with my son. I'm like, if I start snoring, just wake me up. And he starts patting me on the shoulder. He's like, you really got to wake up now. You just got to stay. But I don't know. It after you've had these worlds about to end movies over and over and over and over again, now you can kind of simplify it and just destroy a neighborhood or a city. So that, at least it accomplishes that. It is very complicated, and it doesn't really matter that you can pull that thread. It's not, I don't know, it's just a fun action movie. They didn't really invest too much in the angsty stuff about Tom Holland. They played with it a little bit, but they didn't want to go over the top with it. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of enough to make it watchable. I thought it was supposed to be like 2 hours and 20 minutes, isn't it?
I have no idea.
No, I think it was supposed to be a little shorter because, like, the theory is that they were going for 3,000 minutes for all these phases.
Good.
And stuff. Yeah.
Because I swear to God, that's what the time said. And I'm sitting there looking, I'm like, this movie's over. And there's like 30 minutes supposed to be left. Did they count the trailers? But, I mean, my son liked it. I'm just kind of bored with it anymore. It was what it was. It accomplished what it was trying to accomplish, but this is what the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th Spider-Man movie or movie with Spider-Man in it, so it's fine.
Another thread, though, that is hanging out there aside from the plan of the main character is, I mean, they do address, like, oh, well, this, you know, Thor's off-world and, you know, don't even ask me where Captain Marvel is and that, but... okay, but you still have Bucky. You still got Falcon. You still got War Machine.
Hey, like, Gwyneth Paltrow didn't remember him. Neither did they. It's all good.
Yeah, the best part of the whole movie, and my son keeps quoting it, was I love Led Zeppelin, and it's like he doesn't even get the joke. I don't know, but it is what it is. It's fine.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, I was gonna say I. No, go ahead.
Oh, we're in the era of Marvel movies where we're going to start seeing some weird shit. So,
yeah.
So batten down the hatches, boys. Like, if they're going to do Mysterio, that means we're going to start seeing like some real crazy stuff here soon. They're finally open. They're finally kind of like getting their feet wet. We got the cool stuff out of the way. We fought Ultron, Thanos, all of them. Let's see some weird shit.
And by weird shit, is it more small level then? Kind of like
probably
this one
be
was?
Smaller level, just goofier villains and just try to like... Instead of, like, all the movies being cookie-cutter, I hope they start, like, kind of start getting more, like, experimental with genres and stuff. Kind of like with, like, Winter Soldier, they went the spy route. I think we're going to start seeing stuff like that. Start seeing some crazy stuff.
Are they going to make another movie that ends up being an Avenger-like movie, or is it all going to just be...
That's the rumor. No one knows, because they haven't even announced that Black Widow movie that's coming out next year. Like, it's been filming, all this stuff's been going on, but they haven't actually even, like, announced it yet. All that stuff should be, like, we should be figuring out kind of what's... Yeah, I know. We should be, figuring out the plan at Comic-Con in a couple weeks, but honestly, no one knows what's going on.
Now, we're watching another movie later on this week, or later on the show, you mentioned the... Black Widow movie, and I'm thinking, like, wouldn't it be great if, like, they did a Black Widow movie that's like Weekend at Bernie's, where they just pick up her corpse off that planet and just run it around?
Yes! They're just marionetting her everywhere? Yeah.
Didn't they kind of make that movie already, with that farting movie?
Swiss Army Man?
Oh, yeah.
God, I love that movie,
too. That's a really good movie.
I could it'd be kind of fun to watch Scarlett Johansson play that role.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna name the podcast Scarlett Johansson farting. It's too much witchcraft and pagan stuff that we gotta get it to.
Oh wow.
Midsummer.
Midsummer. You mean the best movie of 2019?
Maybe all time.
It is so freaking brilliant. This movie is just completely insane. I walked out of this movie muttering to myself out loud. My eyes were like just completely pie-eyed, just wide and just kind of looking all over the place. The lights looked funny. I hadn't had an experience quite like that since 28 Days Later, which mostly because that movie has got that unique visual look to it. I'm not sure this one was just disorienting on a different level. I went to a gas station afterward, and just everything looked strange. Like, I saw there was this kind of odd-looking kid standing in the area, and I just kind of looked at him like Reuben from Midsummer, just kind of looked him up and down a little bit. And I was just kind of a little dizzy. I had a bit of a headache. That's the reaction, the initial, like, immediate reaction to Midsummer, because it is so very odd and strange and violent and weird and... the description that Ari Asher gave to this movie is so great. In the Vulture.com interview, he called it Wizard of Oz for perverts.
Yeah.
So brilliant. It's a fairy tale about paganism and positive, like in favor of paganism, I think.
Well, and he's also referred to it as a breakup movie.
Yeah.
Which it is.
It is. That is an interpretation, yes.
And more than anything, it's a very communal movie.
Yeah.
Which Sean and I got to experience on a different level as well. It was just, I don't know. I not knowing Sean had went to the gas station across the street and drove home and all. I mean, I literally did the same thing. I felt drunk. Like, I felt like I was on drugs or something. Because the way, like, there's, the screen's always moving. Even, like, when they're eating, the food's moving. And they're, the flour, everything is just constantly, like, he's purposely trying to mess with your senses. And if you let him, he's pretty successful. I mean, it's probably like any drug or, you know, placebo. You know, if you make yourself believe it, you'll start to go with it. And I definitely went with it. And it was just like, I don't know that I want to watch movies anymore. This is, you're not going to top this. It's its own, this is what it is. It's definitely its own thing. You know, so you don't have to put it at the top of any list, per se. It exists in its own world, but it's just like, I'm sorry, Spider-Man, but I don't care.
Trust me, I went from this straight into Spider-Man, so it was hard. And there was like a small child crying, like, the whole trailers and everything, and the whole time all I kept thinking was that one scene where all you hear is the baby crying in the distance. And I was just like, I'm not ready for this shit, boys. Like, I'm like, I was not having it. Such a disturbing movie. So bright, delightful, and disturbing at the same time.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Oh, loved
it. The sun. The constant sun. So basically, the idea here is that the main character, played by Florence Pugh, she suffers this horrific family tragedy. And this is just prior to her boyfriend, Christian, played by Jack Rayner, joining his friends to go to Sweden for a month and a half. He's about to break up with her until this happens to her, and so he stays with her, and then he eventually feels so bad that he invites her to go to Sweden with his friends, and she decides to go. And they all end up in Sweden at this village in the middle of nowhere, and just from there, just weird shit's gonna unfold. Weird to us, but, like, they're very committed to it. Like, the characters, these Swedish characters are extraordinarily committed to this bizarre ritualistic behavior, and kind of they're kind of portrayed in a way like we're the assholes for not understanding this, and that's kind of interesting. And especially the first, you know, like, major ritual that happens is so shocking and so incredible, and yet the way that they talk about it and the way that they justify it is amazing to listen to. And you're like, I get it. I do understand what you're saying. It's still, I mean, it's so fucking weird, but I get it.
Well, it is, but at the same time, it's like talking to your parents that go to church every week. I get what you're saying. It's weird to me. It seems less weird because they're not necessarily dying and stuff by going to church, but it's still, I get it. And the whole community part of it, anytime somebody feels something, they all feel it at the same time.
Yeah,
that was weird.
And a couple, this is definitely weird towards, like, in one scene.
Oh, wow. That was one hell of a party.
I don't know. I suppose I wouldn't turn it down, but that's... As an actor, I don't know.
As an actor, I want to talk to Jack Rayner all day. I want to say, just tell me everything.
Because sex scenes have got to be weird just in general. Yeah. You know, with the camera. All right, we're going to move over. You two stay there. But here it's, like I said, it's community.
Yeah, it was like some deep cut category shit. Like, it was,
But it was consistent with everything else, you know, when people, when someone died a painful death, they all experienced the pain at the same time. And when, I don't know, it's...
They do not, and he does not hide the violence. He does not, and there's no turning away from the violence. Mm-hmm. The violence is... very brutal. It's in your face sort of violence. Even though, I mean, I'm calling it violence because I don't really know how else to describe it. I mean, the initial one isn't. It's visceral. The first thing you see, not somebody being murdered, but it's still gross and horrifying. I was asking everybody what they were comparing this movie to, and everybody, of course, says, well, it's like The Wicker Man. It's like The Wicker Man. And I see that differently. I think this movie is rather strangely akin to Cannibal Holocaust. For the in-your-face violence, for the ritualistic violence, for the ugly American shtick that's going on, for the even the anthropology that's going on, all those aspects were part of Cannibal Holocaust in a very unique way. And I think that movie's secretly kind of brilliant. And I have always longed to see a filmmaker take on that level of exploitative violence and horror and do it as a kind of as a masterpiece, and that's what Ari Aster has done.
Wicker Man kind of deals with that stuff too, just not on the same level. But oddly enough, I've seen it a couple of times, not a lot. Someone saying it's like if Stanley Kubrick directed The Green Inferno. I'm like, come on, man. The Green Inferno clearly came from Cannibal Holocaust. And it's not good. So, yeah. But no, I mean, that's definitely an accurate comparison. But still, I mean, I think you even said Kubrick directing Cannibal Holocaust when you told me. And I don't know. It just put me in a weird mindset. I put on some music that I don't know why I put it on. I mean, this band Coven that I've been obsessed with for the last 3 or 4 years because they came out in like 1968. They were the first band to do the double horn thing in the metal world. Their first song was called Black Sabbath. Their bass player was named Oz Osborne. Black Sabbath comes out a year later. So... there's an actual satanic mass, like they recorded it and put it on the... And it just, I don't know why, I mean, obviously I know why I put it on, because clearly there's some pagan, and all paganism is not normal religion, is basically what pagan means. Right. But I just put it on, and it was just like, the way each song described the movie was
so
eerie.
Fucking weird, yeah. There's one song on there where like there's a repeated line, everything she touches dies, everything she touches dies. And I'm like, oh my God, did you see this movie too?
And it's like every song is just kind of describing this movie a little too perfect. And it was just awkward and amazing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. We're going to go into this in more details at the end, but
yeah, there'll be a spoiler portion, and we're going to actually be joined by cousin Jeff, one of our regular listeners, who actually has a theory that connects this movie to Hereditary.
Ooh.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to talk about, or you want to save it for then?
I mean, do you have anything left?
Honestly, I was just going to say all I have is spoilers anyway. Like, this movie just messed me up, and I kind of want to talk about it.
The weird thing is we haven't even really mentioned Hereditary. As much as I love that movie, and it was the best movie of last year, I like this better. And I mean, again, they're kind of in their own little world, so you don't really need to compare the two. But
it's how did he do this 2 times in a row? How did he manage to make the most brilliant, shocking movie of the year? I mean, and the production design, again, it's all about the incredible level of detail, you know? Every aspect of Hereditary is perfectly in place. And then again, here, every aspect is perfectly in place. The tapestry you see early on, this very shocking, strange tapestry, turns around and pays off and in the most fucked up and fascinating way. And there's things all over the walls that are indicating, they're telling you what's going to happen to these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And like, wow, really?
We'll get into more of it here in a little bit. Let's move on to the movie I almost watched instantly after this movie was over, and that messed with me as well. I guess I don't have it plugged in. It's an Undisputed Classic. The Virgin Spring.
Yes, The Virgin Spring from 1960 from director Ingmar Bergman tells the story of the family of Tor, played by Max von Sydow. He has a wife, Marita, and a daughter named Karen. And Karen is to go to the church to deliver some candles. She's going to... it's a bit of a ride, but she's going with her hand servant, Ingeri, and along the way she's going to get derailed by three goat herders who are initially very friendly, but then pull her off to the side, rape her, and murder her. Then they turn around and they end up back at Tor's house, not knowing that that's, you know, the father of the woman that they just murdered. And the story plays out from there. This is the movie that inspired Last House on the Left, sort of. I say sort of because he took basically the premise. I mean, just not...
They were saying different things with the movies.
Yeah, it's just the premise, really. It's just the gimmick is what he takes. The three characters, the rape, and then the accidental where they end up at the parents' house. That's pretty much it. There's so much more to The Virgin Spring. There's so much more depth going on. And what I was weirdly fascinated by is that... I was reading a lot about this movie. I wrote a 2,700-word piece about this movie because I was – the thing that people kept getting caught up on is Karen and the death of innocence and so on. But what we don't see in any reviews of this, and I'm fascinated by that, is the seven deadly sins. Did you pick up on this? The seven deadly sins are all over this movie.
Yeah. I guess I was still, like, I watched it almost immediately after watching Midsommar, so I was more caught up on the whole, turning his back. I mean, I guess it was one of the seven deadly sins. I wasn't so much the loss of innocence. To me, that's what Last House on the Left was. Mm-hmm. This was more the father, turning his back on, God. And that those Scandinavian countries, there was very much, you do have these pagan cultures out there, which one of the characters, is a big, believes in Odin and all that. And then you have the normal Christians or whatever, and they turn their back on that for vengeance. And that to me was just, I don't know, I just got really caught up on that. And then really was more digging into the pagan versus Christianity that that black metal movie kind of doesn't touch it as much, but the story behind there of that movie does.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I just always kind of found that area fascinating, and that's kind of where my mind stuck. But I guess that's one of the...
Zach, did you get a chance to watch this?
I didn't. Right. It's on my list, though. I put it in my wish list, so I'm going to be checking it out now.
But the thing about this movie is it's brilliant. I think there's just so many layers to this. I actually think that this is Bergman adapting Dante in a weird way, and the three circles. You've got in the first circle you've got the Inferno, and where he confronts these three demons: indifference, violence, and maliciousness. And that's essentially what the three goat herders stand for. And he defeats them, and he moves on. And then in the next realm is Purgatory, where he's confronting the absence of God in his life and his indifference towards God. And then in the last one, we go to heaven, we go to the divinity. And what we see at the very end is the miracle at the end, the Virgin Spring itself coming forward from underneath the body of Karen, is God having a conversation with him, which is very similar to Dante seeing the face of the triune God in heaven. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. This is because I'm looking at all these other reviews, like, why isn't anybody mentioning that he's adapting Dante? But Dante, of course, in that story lays out the seven deadly sins. And what we have here, the initial sin that sets everything off, and while everybody focuses on Karen's innocence and the death of innocence, Karen is not innocent. Karen's pride is the first thing that sets off this story. The key scene in this entire movie... Karen has woken up late. She doesn't want to go do her chore, which is to take the candles to church. She didn't want to go. She's been laying in bed all morning. To get her out of bed, her mom allows her to wear the finest clothes that she has, these hand-stitched silk created by 15 maidens, and this elaborate dress. And she's going to wear her hair down instead of putting it in the religious, covering. And... the key scene, there's a key moment where she has fully dressed and her mom has combed her hair and she goes to gaze upon herself in a pool of water. And and without even looking up, she says, "Mom, you're in my light." Like, she's very arrogant, very prideful. And I was struck by that. Like she's this pride that she takes in herself is what sets off the lust of the goat herders and leads to her death. So you've got pride, you've got lust, you've got greed, because in her greed, Karen herself is talking not only about her finery, she's also talking to the goat herders when they're having lunch. She's telling them about her father and how he wears the finest silks every day, and he has a golden helmet. To see the house, you have to crane your neck up to be able to see the battlements. She's talking about greed and the greed of her family. But then also the greed leads to the death of the goat herders, because the way that they find out that these goat herders are the ones that murdered their daughter is the goat herders try and sell her clothes to her mother, not knowing that's her mother. Their greed leads to wrath. Max von Sydow, Tor, takes their lives. That's his taking wrath. You've got all of these elements there. Every single one of the seven deadly sins is there. Gluttony precedes every single one of them. They're eating. You see them eat breakfast and talk about her sloth, Karen being lazy and indifferent and not getting out of bed in time. But sloth also exists in Max von Sydow's faith that has become sort of indifferent. He doesn't love God as much as he used to. The absence of God in his life is a sloth of faith. Then you have they've talked about, let's see, which one's the gluttony. Then we have lunch. They're eating this bread that is massive. Like Karen at one point is eating a piece of bread as big as her head. You can't possibly eat all that. And that leads directly into the lust that then kills her. You have dinner, and then the dinner scene precedes wrath. But then you also have envy. Envy comes up because Ingrid's character is envious of Karen. She wishes she could be loved the way Karen is, the way she could dress like Karen. She wished everybody respected her and coddled her the way they do Karen. And she prays to Odin to have something terrible happen to Karen. That's what her arc is. She'll go from believing in Odin and wanting Odin's justice to rejecting Odin and taking on God. That's her arc, to get over her envious sin. And this movie is just thick with this. This layer upon layer of the seven deadly sins are throughout this entire film, and it's really fucking fascinating to watch.
Yeah, no, it was... Yeah, it was just... It was a really easy watch, and, you know, throw in the fact that it's Sweden, made it that much more for me in the moment. And not to spend time with Last House on the Left, because this isn't... I mean... That same plot, different themes altogether, you know, and I think it's good for what it is, but this is it's definitely its own thing, and it really did go well with Midsommar for me, mm-hmm. especially when you're dealing with, you know, pagan beliefs, which is kind of what, I mean, they treat Odin like the devil, I guess, kind of in this movie,
right.
But it is a fascinating watch, and a pretty easy watch, too.
Yeah, I'm checking that out for sure. That sounds tight. Like, I now have homework. That sounds really fucking cool.
The best part, no dumb cops.
Yeah. I don't want to come off like I'm the smartest guy in the room. I don't. Like, but I was reading all these other reviews, and I'm like, why isn't anybody talking about the seven deadly sins?
When were the reviews written?
The 1960s, for the most part.
So in the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I... I didn't really think that at all. And even Last House on the Left, it's more of the, you know, you mentioned Texas Chainsaw Massacre being like the death of the hippie dream, but
yeah.
Last House on the Left, that was their intent. I don't think that was Texas Chainsaw Massacre's intent. That just kind of organically happened, which made it more effective. They were trying really hard with Last House on the Left to do that. And it works, but then you throw in these dumb cops and over the top that you get distracted. But yeah, I'm surprised. I thought maybe that would be... Maybe there'd be more retroactive reviews based on the fact that it was remade by Wes Craven in a way. But no, I didn't really pick up on that part at all. I didn't.
Have you read Dante?
The Wikipedia version. After I watched The House That Jack Built.
Have you heard about that movie?
No. I mean, I've heard about
seen it,
but I don't know anything about
I know what you said about it. That's pretty much it.
And, well, I try not to mention the Dante stuff because that's kind of a spoiler. Mm. But it's a little more, I don't know. It's
messed up, man. It's from what he was really messed up by. Not Midsommar level messed up, but.
Is that one come out recently?
end of last year.
Okay, was that one that everyone like walked Matt out Dillon. Of the?
Yeah, people were walking out of.
Oh, I heard about some of the stuff that happened. I heard about some of the stuff, and I was like, you know, I think I'm good.
But it's like, it would be like if you're watching Midsummer, but then started laughing. Well, I guess there is moments where you laugh, but it's a different kind of laughter. It's just like, really?
It's laughing because it's over the top, not intentional, or
it earned laugh. There, he's trying to get a laugh, but I mean, this Priestley, he's walking through Dante's Inferno is really what the movie is.
Okay,
and so what's happening? You're getting it from his perspective, the unreliable narrator, and. So when he's got a dead kid, he's turned into a puppet, and he's smiling. You know, he's stitched up his face, and he's just in the background sitting there. It's so fucked up that all of a sudden you're just going to start laughing that there's this dead kid. kind of stitched into this puppet out in the background of the scene. I mean, it is weird. But again, it's not Midsummer. I mean, Midsummer is not as weird. It's just fucked up. They're just different movies, and I totally forgot about the House of Jack built. So that really would have been a good movie to put with the show, actually. I hope I didn't ruin it for anybody. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I may be messing it up a little bit. Not the dead kid as a puppet in the corner.
I feel like you can't forget that one.
But yeah, I mean, go see all these movies, really, is what I'm saying. Midsummer, The Virgin Springs, and if you want to see the House of Jack build, it's there as well.
Uplifting weekend.
Anything else before we move on to the popcorn?
You know, not like, it's a very loose take on Dante. Like, it's not, obviously, it's mostly its own story because it's not told in the same linear fashion as Dante's story. You have to kind of, and it's a very loose interpretation. But other than that, I think my theory is kind of good on this.
Oh, I don't disagree with you at all. I think you're right on. I just was more, when I watched it, I was kind of caught up on the, basically got stuck on the Wrath and I can't think of the one where.
And I do want to say that I don't, like, it's a very controversial idea that her dressing the way she did caused the girl herders to do what they did. That is not my interpretation. I don't think that was what Bergman was going for. I think he's talking about the sins, and plot wise to get to the sin of lust that leads to her death, they have to be inspired by seeing her to do that. And so it's not necessarily, I don't think that he's going for that. And I'm certainly not saying that she dressed the way she did and that's why it happened to her. That's not my point at all.
Was that the pride one or was that greed?
Yeah, pride.
Well, the pride, she also separates from her friend. That was kind of pride as well. So, but, you know, I know what you're saying. She didn't deserve it.
No, definitely not.
Well, you dressed that way. Yeah, I didn't think about that till you just said it now, but I know that's not what you meant.
I just wanted to clarify.
No, but I think you're right on, and we can move on to 89.
The other seven deadly sins. The other adaptation of Dante, Weekend at Bernie's.
Oh, yes.
You weren't able to really stream this. I think like one place had it, kind of. You had to subscribe to their service to get it.
I went to a video store.
I didn't bother. I tried. I mean, I made an effort, but I was like, look, if you're not on Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon, and I'm not buying you on Amazon.
No.
So.
Spent $8. I want that $8 back. I forgot how bad this movie was. It was this or Lethal Weapon, and I chose wrong.
You chose poorly.
Yep.
Well, Weekend at Bernie's, 1989. Andrew McCarthy and Jonathan Silverman star, along with Terry Kaiser. Terry Kaiser is the Bernie of the title. He's their boss. They've discovered that somebody is stolen millions of dollars from the company, and they're going to tell Bernie. But before they can get their just rewards, Bernie is murdered. They find out that Bernie was going to have them killed, and that the only way to keep the killer from killing them in their mind is to keep making the killer think that Bernie's still alive. So they decide to take Bernie's body and puppet him around, and that's the joke. That's the movie.
Yeah, and they made a sequel.
fucking made a sequel, yeah.
I never watched it, but I know it involves voodoo, so voodoo. I think I'm good.
Yeah. They do a voodoo curse that gets him up and walking on his own.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
No. No, I've actually never seen it, and I was going to make an effort to see it, and I tried really, really hard outside of paying for it, and I wasn't going to pay for it, so.
I didn't, this movie doesn't get death right.
Nah.
You don't, he doesn't decompose at all over like a 3-4 day period. He doesn't decompose in any way.
Because they keep dumping salt on him, don't they?
Rigor mortis doesn't happen either. Like, he's loose.
Yeah.
it's such a gross movie.
It is.
I always remembered it fondly as a child because I thought it was just, like, funny, super great when I was a kid. Nah, I wanna go back and beat that kid up. That was terrible.
When you're an adult, you realize just how twisted this really is.
Yeah.
They're just puppeting a dead body around.
Yeah, and they're doing it before they realize he's the bad guy, too, which makes it worse. Like, they don't realize until, like, 20 minutes to the end, like, oh, he's bad. This is just. We earned this. No. Instead, they're propping him up at parties, and they're trying to get laid.
Yeah, and Bernie has sex with a woman.
Yeah, they went all Clerks with it.
Clerks before Clerks.
That's where he got the idea.
Yeah, probably, honestly.
I will say Terry Kaiser's pretty amazing for the way that they flop him around throughout this entire movie. I mean, that's a hell of a piece of acting to pull off to make it look like he's dead the entire time. It's pretty impressive.
I'm sure they just put him on ketamine the whole time and flung him around like Leonardo DiCaprio or something. It is impressive. I'm trying to figure out if he had like the easiest job in the world or the hardest, because it was impressive almost.
It's hard. It can't be easy to be that limp all the time.
Kind of sounds like if you've seen the trailer, you've seen it.
Kind of,
more or less.
Because there's really nothing. There's nothing to this movie.
Basically,
there is no other gag other than he's dead and they're walking him around pretending he's alive. That's it. That's the joke.
Yeah, the rest of the movie is a man lying to a woman repeatedly.
Yeah.
Like, there's no plot, really.
No. It's really just a plotless sort of 89-minute nightmare.
Mm-hmm. There's no lesson. There's just a dead man flops on the beach and a kid buries him. Credits. Time to go. it's so bad.
Did anybody see Shag, Haunted Summer, or Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills?
No. Sorry, I did not.
No.
I had only time for Weekend at Bernie's and Lethal Weapon 2.
Lethal Weapon 2 is not available anywhere, which was insane to me.
I got that one at a library.
And I've seen it enough times that I didn't need to see it again, but I mean, I think it's my favorite Lethal Weapon movie.
Diplomatic immunity. It's just been revoked. A dumbass line.
No, it's an amazing line.
I think Ari Aster needs to learn a thing or two from Lethal Weapon 2. That's how you beat the bad guy.
Yeah.
No, all those cheesy lines and all those, you know, diehards and Rambos and Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, I'll take the Lethal Weapon cheesy lines any day of the week.
Yeah.
All four of them, for that matter. I just... Ugh.
And then the fifth one from Sonny and Philly.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon 2 is the one where they're battling against guys from South Africa who are, I don't know, they're drug dealers, arms dealers, what are they?
I think they're smugglers.
Yeah.
Like they're arms smugglers or something like that.
They're, whatever they are, and they begin murdering cops, just hardcore murdering cops to try and cover up their crimes. It's got a lot of, you know, a lot of fun stuff in it, like Roger being trapped on his toilet with a bomb, and that's a favorite scene of mine for some reason. I had like a really, really great memory of that scene. I don't know why.
Well, yeah, and the rig's having his shoulder come out of
I got really like I don't know what to say. I was emotional necessarily, but when they kill Patsy Kensit in this movie, I was like, "Damn!" And that look on his face, the way he sells it, the shoulder bit he does there, like, "Wow, that's pretty awesome."
Yeah, the introduction of Joe Pesci. end of the.
Honestly, I like,
love him.
I thought I was what I was when he was introduced. I'm like, oh shit, is this Lethal Weapon 3? Did I get the wrong one?
It's just amazing the chemistry that they all have in this. You know, obviously Rene Russo comes in later, but they all have it. Even like Lethal Weapon 4, as much as that's kind of a throwaway movie, it's that chemistry is still there. Even if Danny Glover and Mel Gibson have to present something together, they have that chemistry on stage. They're fun to watch. And then you watch this liberal, you know, Richard Donner and Danny Glover, and wondering if Mel Gibson knows what's going on while they got like pro-choice stickers in the background and stuff like that. Maybe he knew. I don't know. But I found that kind of fascinating.
Zach, what are your memories of Lethal Weapon 2?
I remember Joe Pesci, and I always love him. And I'm, like he said, like it just feels like everyone's just like best friends off set. Like they're just like they all get along, and it's just it works. It shows. I love the Lethal Weapon series. I love crappy 80s, 90s action movies anyway. So I'm all for it. Yeah. I haven't seen it in like probably like 5 years. I'm sad I picked Weekend at Bernie's. That's all I'm gonna say.
This was the first sex scene I remember not being able to, like, obviously it's not like they're letting me watch other ones, but this is when I noticed that my dad was like, all right, turn your head or whatever. Or I actually wasn't allowed to watch this one for the longest time. Like, yeah. Three doesn't have any sex really in it at all. And then one, they cut it all out on TV, so I didn't, you know, notice any of that. Two, it was just like, no, you're not watching this one. So that, I don't know, it always had it's probably my favorite. Maybe it's because of that. I built it up too much, but I don't know. If they made a Lethal Weapon 5 for real with like Danny Glover on his deathbed, I wouldn't. It would still be fun.
I'd be down. Like they're just old cops, like still at it, still doing it. I'm in.
I don't even care if you have two new guys and they're just there in the background. It would be fun. I'm on board. It doesn't. Oh, yeah. Even if it sucks, I'm on board.
Oh yeah, that's why I'm so excited for like Jumanji. Like I just love Danny Glover. Like I'm just excited to see him and stuff. Like I always, every single time, I'm just happy.
But
when he
to
pops
that
up.
Point, I mean. Jack Black, Kevin Hart, and The Rock are fun to watch together. Mm-hmm. So even the movie sucks, it'll be fun enough with those three goofing around. So, I mean, and this is kind of the same boat, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's interesting is that of the blockbusters that we've watched, I was surprisingly that still that Indiana Jones is still the most offensive.
I knew we had to get that in here one more time.
Like even that, even this movie isn't as big a jerk off as The Last Crusade.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is because no one knew Mel Gibson was like this until all of a sudden it came out. And I mean, he had interviews back then where he kind of said things that people were like, "Yeah, that's weird," but it didn't go viral because there was no viral.
Yeah, it wasn't him yelling at a cop yet.
No. Next week. We could skip if we wanted to. We got Crawl and Stuber.
We don't skip on this show.
Not going to kill anybody. As of now, we have Taxi Driver penciled in as a classic, unless you want to do something else.
I'm down for Taxi Driver.
An 89 License to Kill and When Harry Met Sally came out, a former classic of ours.
Yeah.
So that's next week. Maybe there'll be something from Netflix that we'll throw in there, depending on what we get to.
You never know when Netflix is going to throw something out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. Like I said, I don't have any clips because they're illegal, and we're trying to move forward. We're going to work on custom clips in the future. But our Key Grip level, Charlie Messing and Jason Bryant, Hall of Fame podcaster, our character actor level, Josh and Beth Paul, Cousin Jeff, who's going to be on here in a second, and Christina Cato, our special effects level, Corey Finneran from Ivy Envy, and Sarah Morrell, and our movie star, Dave Sievers. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon to get yourself a credit on the show and also some selected merch. And now we can try to call Cousin Jeff to talk about the spoilers to Midsommar. Ready?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hey there.
Jeff. What's up?
Oh, I'm working on a paper for Midsummer.
Cool. Say hi to Zach. Zach is here.
Hello.
Hey, Zach.
How's it going?
Peachy keen.
Hell yeah.
All right. Bob, you want to lead the way?
Do I have to? So, I mean, now we're going to do the spoiler part of Midsummer. I don't even know where to start.
Well, I mean, in terms of the spoilers, one of the big things that happens right away is this tragedy that this might be maybe tie into Jeff's theory tying this movie to Hereditary, but the first big like shock of the movie is Florence Pugh's character. Her parents are murdered by her sister in a fashion that is unlike anything I've ever seen in a movie before. She uses like the exhaust from a car and hoses into their hose into their bedroom while they're sleeping, and then she duct tapes a hose to her face. You only see the aftermath of this, but the haze and the dreamlike quality of it, like you're seeing it only through Florence Pugh's notion of what it looked like, is incredible. But then the tie there is between that and and almost at the same time in Hereditary, what happens is Toni Collette finds out about her daughter having her head taken off, and the anguish and the screaming and the crying, they're extraordinarily similar.
Yeah, I found that like when she starts screaming, she almost doesn't stop for a full 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's that unnerving screaming that you're left to imagine because you don't really see, you just kind of see the aftermath of her laying in her boyfriend's lap as it cuts to the credits. But it's, you imagine that she's been doing that since she called him, which would have taken, you know, several minutes to get to her.
Right.
If not more. And it's that same thing where, you know, Toni Collette, you never see her see the body with no head,
right?
But you can imagine it far worse than what, you know, what they could show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, the way that the camera just kind of followed that cop going through the house,
yeah,
the way it was shot was just so fucking creepy. Like you said, it's almost like dreamlike and just like it's all hazy and stuff, and it's that duct taped face at the end, man. Like, oh, man. I saw that when I went to sleep that night. Like, that was bad.
Well, and the whole time they're presenting her as this, you know, crazy girlfriend, you know, right, who's overreacting to her sister not responding to a text or whatever.
Oh, that message was, I mean, how brilliantly crafted was that message? I'm going and mom and dad are coming with me. Like, well, fuck. That would fuck you up.
Yeah.
Man.
So some of the parts of the suicide sequence for me that kind of made me think that it's not necessarily a direct sequel, but kind of a spiritual sequel to Hereditary. You see the look on the dead sister's face and the puke all down her, and then it just lingers on her face for a second. Uh-huh. Like it, almost like it does with Charlie's head when you finally do see it in Hereditary.
Right.
As the cops are walking slowly up, you know something's going on, and you know that it's not good. You can tell it's not going to be good because she's been obsessing about it for the first 20 minutes of the movie. And it's almost to the point where when in Hereditary, when Annie's mom is dead and she's kind of going through getting everybody to the funeral, and right, Gabriel Byrne comes up and it's this slow build, like, you know, something has happened, and the way that they're telling it makes it even more sinister than what they could show.
I totally get that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the you know, Toni Collette in that movie, she plays it so impassively, that part of it, and it makes it that much stranger because she's not really having a natural human reaction to someone having died. But then when her daughter is killed, that's a truly natural reaction to having someone die, and that, and right, that dichotomy is really fascinating.
Well, she didn't, not to dwell too much on Hereditary because I know we're talking about Midsommar, but Hereditary is one of the best movies made last year, just hands down.
That was my number one.
Yeah. I've been working on a poster for it, and I've watched it a couple times recently, and then I watched it again yesterday after I saw Midsommar for the second time. And she, in that movie, having been estranged from her from most of her family for the last 15 years, really, since her son was born, and she was estranged from her mother then, and then her mother had to come back, and that created an estrangement between her son and her, and then her daughter and her, and her husband later. You know, it's like everybody is slowly taken away from her, whereas in Midsommar, everybody is taken away from her right at the beginning, and then she builds up a relationship with the community.
It's interesting. That's very interesting, because I was just thinking about the unnatural reactions. You have her at the beginning talking about her mother's death very impassively. Then she has the reaction to her daughter's death that is, you know, the anguish and the crying. And then in this movie, you've got Florence Pugh. Her character is reacting with that deep, that huge anguish to the death of her parents and her sister. But then at the end, she's strangely impassive watching Christian burn to death.
Well, I take that. Okay, so in Hereditary, where we see the slow degeneration of Peter into Paimon and how he's vulnerable, he becomes more and more vulnerable throughout the movie, she becomes less and less vulnerable throughout Midsommar. Hmm. And as Danny becomes more accepted into the community, and she accepts more of what the community is actually doing, because you see through when the older couple commit suicide, and she's just, you know, she's rocked because she thinks it's her family, and she dreams about them
right
in that position later. Everything that happens from then on in is a little more kind of pedestrian to her. She takes it a little more like, oh, okay, I get it. Whereas you see the other people in the group that come with her freak out more. Except for Christian. Christian just acts like a douchebag the entire time. And kind of deservedly gets what he gets. But that smile, the very last shot of her where she's smiling as she looks at the fire, and she realizes that, you know, it's been family, family, family. And every time that word has come up, triggered, previously in the movie, she's broken down. Yeah. But they say, you're our family now. And for a second, she kind of goes into that, I'm going to break down mode. And you see it kind of switch in her face that, wait a minute, no, this is a family.
Yeah, Bob, you were messed up by that smile, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. That I was trying, because you told me you were trying to compare it to a movie, and obviously Wicker Man with the bear is the one thing that,
yeah.
I'm trying to think, he's not talking about that, that's too obvious. And so I was trying really hard to think of what movie ends in a smile, and that messed me up. And I mean, Ari Aster had said that really where the Hereditary and Midsommar are kind of the same as the theme of codependency and family, but this one digs into it even deeper than that one did. And even with that smile at the end, she's still kind of becoming part of that family as well. She's being, you know, being turned into that community. So it's not, even though she's becoming free, her codependency is jumping from her family to their boyfriend to now this community. So it's not like she's totally free either at the end. So it's, I don't know. The whole thing was, it's even hard to talk about without making it. I was talking to Zach when you stepped away for a second shot, and it was, if you have to go tell somebody about this movie, one, you can't really say anything without spoiling it, but two, you can't describe it and make it sound good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just easy to go, it's fucked up, go see it.
Yeah.
You have to be a particular kind of moviegoer to be able to take a movie like this and take it in. And it was fascinating. The second time I saw it, because I had to see it again, there was a child there, and I just kept looking over, like, why did you bring this child to this movie?
You know what, though? Okay, so we went to see the midnight release of the Friday the 13th remake, and there were these two women who brought four kids. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. So, you just got a lot of explaining to do is all.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, did you guys notice, too, that with the community that she was going to become a part of, I think one of the reasons that she felt like they were a safe community was because they did this exaggerated, empathetic yelling or laughing or breathing whenever somebody around them was in pain or very happy.
Right.
And when she's freaking out after she sees Christian and the redheaded girl, whose name I can't remember, when she looks through the keyhole and you've already seen it, so you don't need to see it, but she sees it and then she, you know, does the cinematic throwing up where it's just a little, as much as she can hold in her mouth. Yeah. And that always bothers me. Sorry. But when they surround her, and they treat her like one of them, and literally as a whole, like a hive mentality.
Yeah.
And they, you know, at first they're like breathing and they're like, ooh, ooh, trying to calm her down. But then when they realize she can't be calmed down, the crescendo of their screaming along with hers and they're rocking back and forth as one, I think that's where she kind of could take the turn to say, they understand me, they get me, they love me, they are with me, they are me.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, it seemed like every time that someone was experiencing any sort of emotion, whether it's pain or fear or, you know, excitement, I suppose, if you want to go to that sex scene, they were experiencing it with the person going, you know, it's almost like they were feeling it too. Whether they were or not, I guess it's up to your own interpretation. Probably not.
No.
But they definitely believed they were, kind of like Catholics believe they're really eating Jesus when they go to communion. So right. It's, but it was, I don't know.
It's strange, but it is, it also, as much as it's weird because it makes sense, like what they're doing in a logical way. It makes sense to do that, to get, it's like extreme empathy. At the same time, it's incredibly unnatural and unnerving if you've never seen it before. And that adds to the tension and the experience of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, even our text conversation that Sean and I were having after I had seen it, I'd imagine if you hadn't seen it and you're just reading through it, like, these guys are idiots. You know? It's, I mean, we're...
Well, I mean, to be fair.
Well, exactly. But in the moment, you know, and even either one of us probably could look at it, you know, outside of the context and say these two are idiots. But in the moment, it was just like we're listening to the same record at the same time, being like, isn't this fucked up? And it just... That communal, you know, you get to lay your guard down. You notice, okay, Sean feels the same way I feel. So then it just kind of spirals from there. And it just really made for a really unique and interesting experience that I don't know how you – I mean,
we were on the phone screaming to each other. Ah!
I mean, we were listening to a satanic mass, if that – like a real one.
So
and Sean didn't think it was dumb.
How I feel that this is kind of a spiritual sequel to Hereditary is because everything Hereditary does takes place in the dark.
Right.
And with muted tones and everything like that. Whereas, and at the end, it's the darkness that overtakes Peter. And with Midsommar, it's the opposite. It all starts off in the dark and then everything that takes over Danny takes place in the light, and not just regular light, but constant bright light. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I discussed with Sean before was the triangle imagery and the way that Ari Aster uses artwork to illustrate what's happening, what's going to happen in the movie, how he basically spells out the movie for you in the very first panel of Midsommar with the painting. There's, you know, the three family members who are dead, and then she's with Christian, and then they all are walking into the thing, and then there's the Maypole dance. And in each one of those situations, they're walking with death because there's a skeleton with them at all times.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like, and with Hereditary, a lot of that is spelled out with the miniatures mm-hmm. and little bits and pieces here and there. And I also mentioned to Sean that I think that one of the things that ties them together is, and I don't know if it was intentional or if it's just something that Ari Aster is very into, but the symbolism of triangles is all throughout both movies. When in Hereditary, when Joan, who is the friend of Annie's mother, when Annie goes over to Joan's house and she's looking for Joan and she's knocking on the door and they pan in and there's on the wall, there are two of the symbols, the payment symbols. And on the table is a picture of Peter surrounded by a triangle. There's a triangle in her mother's room that she goes, when she goes in to look in there for Charlie, and she sees it on the floor and she just doesn't think anything of it. And then the very last shot of Hereditary is in the treehouse and everybody's, you know, bent over, worshiping Payman, who's standing in the back, and it's just a black screen with a gold triangle of the actual treehouse. And then if you come into Midsommar, the main vessel for her kind of rebirth into the family is that triangular shaped house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys listen to or read much about mythology and Christian mythology, but the vessel, the Holy Grail, and if you look at Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, there's a triangle between Jesus and what some people now think is Mary Magdalene, who is supposed to be Jesus' wife, whatever, but it's a triangle shape, and that's the vessel. And I feel like the vessel, the triangle as a vessel, imbues both of these movies with that kind of symbolism, whereas Annie keeps seeing a triangle, and she thinks that, you know, something's going on with it, but it turns out that Peter is the vessel at the end of Hereditary. And then when the vessel disintegrates at the end, that's when Danny is finally free to embrace this new family unit that she's been searching for, you know, the last 6 months.
I dig it.
Yeah. One thing I got pointed out to online, I don't know if you guys noticed, but they explained kind of like how they see seasons, where it's like spring, it's like your infancy.
The life, the three parts of life.
Yeah. Did you notice that her parents died in winter? And then she kind of found her family and kind of started growing up as the year went on. And by summer, she was kind of completely enveloped by their weird culty behavior.
Hmm.
Like someone pointed that out. I only saw it the one time, yeah. But that's kind of the lens I've been seeing it in. And
now, I know that we talked about too, Sean, that this has a lot of aspects that could be taken from Cannibal Holocaust.
Right.
Phil Nobile Jr., who is the editor chief of Fangoria magazine, put on Twitter the other day. I follow horror Twitter and gay horror Twitter pretty much exclusively on these days. And he said that, and he showed GIFs side by side of how it mirrors a lot of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I've heard that too. Yeah, I've heard that too. And a lot of that, you know, somebody was pointing out the sun, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How they both take place, most of it, in the bright sunlight.
Yeah.
So.
I guess I could see that. I haven't seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre in a minute, but I could see that. It's kind of just...
You don't watch it annually? What's wrong with you?
Oh, God, I know, man. I need to get on that. No, I... But the whole... Having a horror movie in the daylight, I enjoy a lot. Like, I want to see more stuff like that, because I like... Like where you can't hide behind the darkness and just right. like hide all the gritty fucked up stuff. Like,
well, especially like when you're that. Going with a spiritual type of paganism type thing, where it's easy to hide in the dark. There, you know, I can see a serial killer kind of thing. Okay, that makes a little bit more sense. Easier to do a serial killer movie in the daytime, but when you watch like a witch movie, they're usually naked dancing on a campfire. You know, they're not in the broad daylight. Mm-hmm. You know, in summertime, it's. Which made it almost more eerie. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, the constant sunlight is another disorienting element. It's disorienting to them, and it's disorienting to us. I think the key scene is that suicide scene. These two people who've reached the age of 72 in this culture, in Sweden are taken off in robes, and they're carried to the top of this mountain, and then they just leap off the mountain. And these Americans, who have no experience of this type of thing whatsoever, lose their shit, because who wouldn't, you know, other than these group of people, this group of Swedes who are like, this is just normal. This is what we do when we, yeah, you hit 72, you just leap off a mountain and die.
And I can't wait till I'm there.
Yeah.
And I'll, knowing this kind of was going to happen, you know, you assume some version of that's going to happen. It still was like, holy shit.
the visceralness of it, the real of it, that first woman's face exploding the way it does, it doesn't feel fake. It feels so incredibly real.
Similar to Cannibal Holocaust, it feels like you want to bring the actor in and be like, are you sure you're alive?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it looks like the way they shot it and how she hits it, but then when there's the recoil,
yeah,
and that's when you see everything, it was almost like a shotgun blast effect.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it was just like, oh. And I the first time I saw it on Wednesday night, I was in a theater that was absolutely full of people. And having seen so many horror movies and, you know, seeing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Part 2, and like all the gore stuff over and over, I'm a little desensitized to it, but it was still, even though you knew it was coming, you were like, oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who was sitting directly next to me, when he's like, oh, no, don't jump. Oh, my God, she's going to jump. And then when she hit, he goes, oh, fuck, just like really quiet. But then when the head came back and you saw like it all kind of spread out, he goes, fuck. So that was great. I mean, and as soon as you saw the guy with the big mallet, I knew something.
Oh, man.
I knew that something was going to happen with that mallet. There's no way. It's like you can't show a gun in the first act and not use it in the third act. But.
Right.
That was incredible.
Back to that. I mean, as soon as they start walking out for dinner, the two people that jump to the death, you know that this is their last supper. I mean, they don't specifically tell you that, but anybody who's ever seen a movie knows that something is going to happen to these two. This is probably their last meal, and they spend so much time. They just take their time getting there, and it's just such this eerie tension the entire time up until bam, shits the rock.
Yeah, because they just brushed off that what happens at 72 thing. Like they're like just
death, whatever. And
I had to get up and go to the bathroom really quick the first time I saw it, so I missed the part where Josh is talking to Pelle and, you know, talking about basically ritual suicide.
Right.
And it was the scene where Christian finds out that it's Danny's birthday and gives her a little cake, like a piece of shit that he was. sorry, I'm just really glad he died. He was horrible. And then when they came out and they were going to sit down at the table, and Josh turns to Pelle and goes, are those the two? And Pelle just kind of shakes his head. Yes. I was like, I didn't get that the first time, and I'm like, oh, he knew everything,
right?
But he was one of the most that was most upset by it.
Well, I think the character of Josh in that moment is key, because he gives you an indication early on that he knows what's about. Like, he knows this ritual. He doesn't. I think it doesn't dawn on him that they were actually going to carry it out. I thought they were. He was still
more symbolic.
I think. Yeah. I think when they actually got there and she was actually standing up there, he thought maybe that they were just going to enact it as opposed to actually go through with it.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. Kind of all that. I'm gonna give to like William Jackson Harper though. Like that dude. Do you guys watch The Good Place at all? Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is like low-key one of my like favorite actors right now, so I enjoyed that a lot, where it was kind of like he just played that whole I'm just gonna play along, we'll see what happens, it could be real, could be fake, but we might see some people die. I just kind of enjoyed how he just kind of played that.
But he also his shock though, the way he runs from it is makes it that much more incredible. Like he really didn't think this was actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, like you said, that he's gonna, he thinks that it's more they're going to act it out but not actually go through with it. And then when they do, it's just like, oh. Or as the guy next to me was like, oh, fuck.
And and the other two, there's another two characters that are key to that scene. It's Simon and Connie, these two other characters that we don't really know very well. They've been brought to the village by another villager. In the story, it goes that Pelle is the character who brings these four friends of his with him to this Swedish village, promising them drugs and sex for over a month. And this is a thing that this village does, that they go out and they bring in outsiders to come to their village and go through these rituals with them. Where was I going with that? Simon and Connie, their reaction, their very natural, like, fucked up, like, this is seriously fucked up, we're leaving right now, this is so horrific, we gotta go. That reaction is like, yes, you're me in this moment.
Oh, yeah. That was me watching that movie. I was like, is it over?
But at the same time, they do a good job with the four characters we've been following, or the three characters we've been following the whole time, of why they wouldn't. You know, they were horrified, but right. Then they understand that the culture exists and that they're trying to learn about it. So
I think
they're willing to go with it.
I think Florence Pugh's character, I think she's already so traumatized that she's processing what she's seeing. Like, she can't even believe it. Christian is, you know, insanely detached. He's always has been throughout the entire film. Josh has a natural reaction, but Simon and Connie are the only ones who, like, they don't really understand, and they're just completely blown out of the water by it.
Right.
Yeah.
And it also, Ari Aster said that this was a dark comedy.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Will Poulter's character comes in. You know, as the, you know, kind of comic relief.
Right.
But I feel like there's scenes missing with him. Because he just goes off, and he doesn't see the suicide ritual or anything like that. And I have to think that there's something, there's got to be a dropped subplot with him where something happens. Maybe he's, maybe, you know, seduced a little more while he's supposed to be napping. But I think that his reaction, in my mind, would have been more like, you know, Connie and, what's his name?
Simon,
yeah. I think he would have been more like them, and that's one of the reasons maybe he wasn't included in it,
right.
Where he said he was just going to nap.
Maybe. I think you needed you needed that part where he was told about it to kind of illustrate what an asshole that he is. Because he goes, yeah. Dude, I can't believe I missed that. Why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
Like, that reaction, just that he's almost, if you want to talk about dark comedy, he's almost like the Stifler of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that was, you know, very intentional. Like, that's, you have, somebody pisses on the tree, and the comic moments that I kind of got with were when he pissed on the tree and then the guy was yelling at him and was going to, like, basically was going to kill him right there.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting for the, you know, whatever ritualistic murder that they did to him after he was knocked out, I feel like he's, you know, he's still staring at me and the guy is just like looking at him, like, and everybody laughs because you need that laugh at that moment because right. The tension is so thick.
Yeah.
And I think there were points where I was like, all right, I really wish he'd lasted a little longer. Like, maybe almost till the end, so he could be, you know, like, talk about how fucked up it was or whatever.
Yeah, but at the same time, I didn't miss him. Like, I thought the way he went out was kind of perfect. I do have a question, though. I've had somebody say that, because when Will Poulter's character goes off with this girl and he is murdered off screen, his skin is removed in some sort of ritualistic fashion that, I mean, you can still see it's him in his face.
Right.
Somebody had said on Twitter that was Ruben that was wearing his face. I didn't think so either. I thought it was the girl he went off with, is what I thought.
No, you can clearly see when he's standing there, you can see it's a guy because he's naked from the waist down.
Huh, okay.
But Ruben is, when Josh walks in to photograph the book, you see Ruben laying down.
Right.
Behind him, like he goes by him and Ruben's asleep, And it wasn't made clear enough. I think there should have been. I thought it was Ruben the first watch because he was going. But you clearly see the guy who walks in wearing Will Poulter's face. You see him come in the door and leave the door open.
Right.
And it should be clearer. Like Ruben should be standing behind him or something when he's grunting and groaning in order for you to know that it's not him. But the first time I saw it, I thought it was him. And then I was like, wait a minute. I figured quite honestly, if they were going to make him naked from the waist down, he would have had some huge deformed penis or something. But
I thought the way I saw it was, I thought it was the girl he went off with, because it looked to me like all of Will Poulter was there, but his penis was missing.
Right.
That's the impression that I had. Like his dick had been cut off.
No, you could see it if you look close enough, and you know, why wouldn't I? But no, you can see it, and it was my understanding that it was another guy who was wearing his face. Hmm. So.
Yeah, I thought his dick was cut off too, but I guess I also, it was so fast that it was like, what did I just see? Which is kind of a lot of what this movie was.
I just figured I'd watch that movie again and catch that whole thing. And all of it, I was just like, I don't know what that the is fuck the, just went down.
That is the one moment that is played, not necessarily in darkness, but like in a shadow, because this church has fewer windows than the rest of the area, because the sun is out the entirety of the movie. Aside from one nightmare sequence that Florence Pugh's character has.
Right. Can I just say, as the gay one of the group, yes, we got full frontal male nudity, but we had to go through a lot of female nudity to get to it. I'm very disappointed.
It is, of course, speaking of the sex scene that takes place in this movie. So Christian, throughout this, of course, Christian had been talking about trying to break up with his girlfriend, and his friends had been telling him that he needs to break up with her before they go to Sweden so they can go and have all this sex with all these Swedish girls. And so finally we're in Sweden. He's brought her along. They're very disconnected from each other. They're growing more and more disconnected throughout, as he kind of disconnects from his friends and disconnects from everybody because he's kind of a prick that way. But finally, he's being, this whole time, he's being kind of hypnotized by this girl, Anna, this redheaded girl, who takes a liking to him immediately upon seeing him and begins to enact this spell upon him, which we get to see on this tapestry right when they arrive. The tapestry shows specifically a naked girl cutting off her pubic hair, placing that pubic hair into a pie, then taking her vaginal blood and putting it into a cup. And all this happens to Christian. This is served to him, and it's supposed to make him fall in love with Anna. And
yeah, you see the eyes, like the hypnotized eyes after he eats and drinks.
Yeah.
On the tapestry.
And so he gets hypnotized, essentially. He's drugged, and he goes off with this girl, and it's like the final break between him and his girlfriend. And he goes off to have sex with this Anna girl, and there are all these women standing around completely nude, and Anna is presented for him. This is happening in the church, so there's a lot of symbolism going on here. But then this enacts this sex scene that is just, it's shocking. All the way, like we've been talking about the communal emotions, the communal sex here is essentially what's happening. All the women begin to feel essentially like they're having an orgasm as Anna is having sex, and they don't necessarily jump in, but at one point...
But they don't not jump in.
Right.
One point, there's one lady gets right up and makes eye contact with him. Another one starts pushing his butt cheeks into her.
When she got in close, that was the moment my entire theater started laughing, and it didn't let up until that scene stopped.
I'm pretty sure we were at the same screening, because I thought I saw you coming out of it, but there was a lot of laughter during that scene.
I'm going to say that it's helped to be funny by the fact that he looks like Chris Pratt and Seth Rogen had a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
And that look on his face when she starts singing, he's like, I'm sorry, what?
That's right. She started singing.
And then he gets
into
it. You know, he's like, all right, it's just music. And she's touching me now. And all right, I'm surrounded by women.
Then his butt got grabbed.
Yeah. Which we've all been there, but it's just...
Speak for yourself, bud.
You never walked into a room full of people and just...
you just gotta help them out. You gotta give them a couple hands.
I mean, I don't know.
We'll just say if I've ever walked into a room full of people and having sex, it's not a turn off. It's a turn on.
Oh, no, I agree. It's just, there's also a moment of awkwardness. Where it's just like, I guess I'm going to go with it.
That's why I've never understood orgy culture. Like, how is this not the most awkward thing in the world?
Yeah, imagine the smell. They've been out in the middle of nowhere for like a week. I didn't see a single shower.
And this is like my misogynistic comment for the day. Do you think they all sink up?
Oh, God.
Oh, man. That's why they had that feast.
Oh, I talk about the detail. The detail that Ari Asher brings. Look at Jack Rayner's penis after that scene. Detail.
I didn't catch that. Oh, yeah. Is this the first time a major movie showed someone get their Red Wings? Like, is that the first time?
Oh, my God.
Wow. I can't recall that ever happening before.
Oh, man. Oh, I can't wait to buy this movie. Watch it in 4K. 4K, yeah.
Jesus Christ. Oh, man.
All right.
Now, I live in Chicago, and a couple weeks ago, Andersonville, which is a neighborhood, it's a primarily Swedish neighborhood. They have what's called Midsummerfest.
Right.
They have the maypole and the dancing and everything. And all I could think about was watching this movie. It's like, wow, they should really transform Andersonville Midsummerfest next year.
I'm staying home.
We got a spot down this way in Illinois, in our part of Illinois, Bishop Hill. That is a wholly Swedish area. Like, it's everything they do is Swedish. They have a Midsummer. They had it just last month. And they have a maypole, and like they've got all that stuff, and people in full Swedish costume. And
triangles and everything.
It's, I cannot even look at Bishop Hill right now.
But black metal makes sense all of a sudden.
Right? I don't know. Jeff, I told you to listen to Coven. Did you listen to Coven?
You know what? Not yet, but I will today.
Especially the album Witchcraft.
Yeah. And we haven't even touched on that. Like, the witchcraft is there. It's there, but it's not pronounced. It's not supernatural. When I was talking to you, I was talking about it as a more of a practical form of witchcraft, really. Because you do have that ritual that the girl does to entice Christian. But you also have a number of times where like the tea that she drinks, or the whatever it is, I think it's some sort of tea that she drinks right before she does the maypole dance, is imbued with something. You know, the drug taking is not supernatural, and it's not witchcraft per se, but it does make you more susceptible to believing in some sort of higher power or some sort of outside power. And so I think the elements there, like all the ritualistic stuff, does evoke witchcraft.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, most people, when they think of witchcraft, they think of, you know, like supernatural magic and things like that, when in most real-world witches, it's more about runic alphabets and, you know, stuff like ritualistic stuff that's not necessarily, you know, levitating somebody off the floor or anything like that.
Right, and they'll talk about Satan or whatever, but they're not meaning like the being, the devil. It's more natural than the earth, and it's, I don't know, it's, and yeah. Coven, I mean, the lady, the singer, it was a person, a practicing witchcraft person, so it made it that much more effective.
Yeah, I swear to God, Ari Asher had to be listening to Coven when he was writing this movie. He had to.
But when you listen to that album, you start thinking, okay, so Ghost had to be listening to Coven. Tenacious D had to be listening to Coven. Black Sabbath had to be listening to Coven.
I'm definitely going to be listening to Coven tonight. That's a good list right there.
All that's missing is a bear costume.
Which we needed to get to at some point.
Yeah. I'll go pick up a bear costume on the way home.
So did you guys see at the beginning of the movie in Danny's apartment when she's after, you know, when it's May and she's waking up in the bright sunlight, above her bed is a little girl holding the face of a bear?
Yep.
On the wall?
Oh, yeah.
And that bear is throughout the artwork in the movie.
And it's, yeah.
I loved it. There's a scene early on, right before the tapestry scene, where Simon and Connie are walking with the Swedish guy that they're there with, Pella's brother, actually. And they go, "Are we not going to talk about the bear?" And he goes, "It's a bear." That's like, okay.
Well, so on the subject of artwork that kind of tells you the story, aside from the very first panel that opens up, you know, into the night, there's the bear with the little girl holding its face. Above her sofa, when she's crying, there's what I'm assuming are the phases of the moon, mm-hmm. which would also then, you know, go to Midsummer. There's in the guy's apartment during the party, on top of the refrigerator, you can see the scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, shit.
There's a little, like, a portrait of him,
Did you hear what Ari Asher called this movie, Jeff? Did you hear what he said? He said this is actually Wizard of Oz for perverts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And later on, Will Poulter is a scarecrow, basically.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, that is fucking horrifying.
With the jester hat on. You know, it's like, so, okay, that's all this foreshadowing. And I love, love, love that kind of stuff.
I do too. And again, it just speaks to Ari Aster's incredible, remarkable attention to detail.
Ari Aster, by the way.
Either way. He doesn't listen.
Just
we're
call
fine.
Ari, because you're on a first name basis.
But yeah, they sell a guy into a bear suit and burn him alive.
Yeah.
That's how I want to go out.
There's this incredible ritual at the end after Florence Pugh, she's become the May Queen, and she's wrapped in flowers, and she has to decide who is going to die among the nine people that they've set aside to be burned to death as an offering. And obviously, they've already got a few victims. You know, the other friends are already dead. Two men volunteer, and then there's one more spot left.
One wins the lottery.
Yeah. So they pick one at random out of via this lottery, but then they also have Christian, and she needs to choose between that guy and Christian, who will die. And she chooses Christian, as we come to find out. And for reasons that I'm still kind of trying to grasp, they hollow out the bear that we've seen earlier and sew Christian inside of it and then put him in the temple and burn him alive.
Okay, so two things on that. I don't necessarily know that she chose Christian because she was so out of it by that point. I think that it was predestined that it was going to be Christian, and they made a show because you never actually see her choosing him. He just suddenly is.
Right, but I think I do think she did. I do think she did.
Yeah, I mean, that's open interpretation, but I'm just saying, like, I think there's a reason that we never actually hear her say those words, you know, like, "I choose Christian."
I think it was
because I think you want it to be left up to whether she's crazy by this point, whether she's so out of it she can't make that choice, or whether she's feeling vindictive enough that she did.
But like Zach says, by not letting you know for sure, that smile at the end is that much more creepy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's a nice little cherry on top of that horrible sundae.
Well, and the second part is when Christian is called into Steve's house. And there's all the, it looks like wallpaper.
Right.
With all the illustrations, and you see mushrooms, and you see lots of little symbols that, again, take pieces of what you've already seen and what you're about to see. And one of the panels that he's looking at is a bear being burned.
Right.
So I saw that the second time I saw it. I'm like, oh, okay, so he's looking at his future.
Yeah.
In this little house. Because that's when she says, you're going to fuck Anna and you're going to have a baby and then we're going to burn you alive in a bear costume like you just saw on the wall there. And she was great. Steve was great.
Yeah, that was a creepy character.
That combination of like authority and gentleness.
Yeah, just so. Confidence, just pure confidence. She full-on true believer.
She was great.
And when the volunteers start screaming in the fire, and then they all scream with them.
Oh, yep. Man. Again,
well, at first, they looked so happy that he was screaming because he knew it was happening, you know?
Right.
And then they all started to go into this ecstasy, and that's when Danny, I felt like if they hadn't cut where they cut with her smile, she would have gone into ecstasy too.
Right.
Because she was finally part of them.
Yeah.
That's kind of, because I couldn't remember because I've only seen it once, but part of me just kind of felt like maybe they briefly showed her starting to go into the ecstasy. I couldn't remember if they just cut during the smile or if she starts to go with them or not. Cause,
I don't remember.
But in my mind, she did, like Jeff just said, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, she was already full cult. Like, she was already in there at that point.
Yeah, the screaming and everybody doing that all at once and community. We were listening, like I said, we were listening to Coven afterwards, and on that record, there's some chanting going on,
mm-hmm.
and the unnatural quality of a chant, especially one that is, you know, like Hail Satan and whatnot in that record, all that stuff. But there's something just genuinely unnerving about chanting under just about any circumstance, unless it's like monks. And even then, it's weird.
Well, yeah, I grew up Catholic. If I go back to church at a family thing, it is weird to me that we stand and say, I mean, it's just as creepy. I mean, I shouldn't say just as creepy. No one's dying and being burned alive, but
that you see.
There's other, in that particular mass, just in the big picture, yes, horrible things are happening. But it's still just weird that people are, you know, their brains are turned off to the point where they're just, it's easy to get wrapped up in something. And, you know, we all do it. It's just a matter of what we're getting wrapped up in. But yeah, it, I don't know. It's that chanting really is the real deal.
Yeah. Did anybody stay after the credits?
Mm-mm. No.
Apparently, and there's no after credits scene, but one of my friends who saw it said at the end they cut to this like weird like Scandinavian song, this Swedish song at the end that is very unnerving. Now, which there was one that popped up on our Facebook page. Did you post that?
No, it just popped up. Yeah, I did. I can't remember why I posted. I was just doing a deep dive. I don't even know what it is. probably was a song at the end of the credits, and I didn't even know it.
Who do you think was in the pies? Because at first I thought it was Simon, but now I think it was Will Poulter. Because at the end, when Christian finds Simon hanging in the chicken coop, covered with flowers,
mm-hmm.
and his flowers in his eyes, it took me until the second viewing to see that. Instead of him just being flayed and that his skin was off in the back, those were his lungs. He was still alive the whole time.
Yeah.
I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, because his lungs, they were breathing in and out.
Yeah,
that was messed up.
And I was like, the first time I saw it, like I said, I thought it was just his skin, but then he was breathing. I'm like, what the fuck? He's still alive. The whole time. So I'm assuming that it was Will Poulter's character who they were eating in the meat pies.
Very well could have been.
Oh, man, I'm starting to think maybe 4K is not the right call when this comes out.
And I think personally that Danny, she kind of was coming around a little earlier than I thought the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
Because when Simon went missing and the elder was saying, oh, no, he was driven into town. And I can't remember her name.
Connie,
thank you. When Connie was like, this is fucked, and then she runs off, I felt like in me or anybody else who wasn't kind of on board with this behavior would have said, wait, what's really going on? And then, you know, even though she started packing her stuff shortly thereafter, I feel like her reaction was almost a little... Oh, okay. Well, he's probably dead, but whatever. They're being nice to me.
Again, I think part of it is the whole journey kind of begins with that suicide thing. That set such a bar for how weirdly traumatized she already is, that anything that happens after that is going to be like, well, that's weird, but it's not people, you know, it's not people's skulls smashing on a rock, so.
But even besides all that, she's, you know, even with her family, as, you know, she's a codependent person.
Yeah.
And they established that pretty early on in the movie and throughout.
Yeah, and you know, when you have Pella entering in at that moment and offering her the support that she's not getting anywhere else. Yeah.
Right.
One of the worst things that really bugged me was how codependent she was, and every time Christian would say something, she's like, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." I'm like, I want to stand up in the middle of the theater, like, "Girl, stop apologizing." That was particularly triggered me for some reason, because I, you know, you see that so much, and as someone who spends enough time on Twitter to, you know, deal with having to hear these stories about how guys gaslight women the way he was, and having to hear somebody say, "All I did was say I was sorry," and then see it play out in real life, it was just kind of like, it brought the real world in a little bit. I was just like, oh, that was one of the most horrifying things, is how he just manipulated her.
Very true.
But I love when they bring the real world into stuff, like, because that's what makes it that much more. It's, you know, it's not a guy in a spider suit jumping around. You know, you're the real world.
Although
being
I really
there.
Enjoyed that.
Yeah, I guess.
This movie is brilliant. It's filled. It's layered and ingenious and visually shocking. I walked out of the theater and I was well alone, so there was nobody around me. And I went by myself the first time, and I walked to my car, and the whole time I was just going, "They sewed him in a bear suit and they lit him on fire. They sewed him in a bear suit and lit him on fire." Like, just over and over and over again. I could not bring my mind around. Like, I knew, I've seen The Wicker Man and I've seen Nicolas Cage, and that didn't even enter my head for a moment.
The only reason it entered my head is because right before I went and saw it, a lady at work, I showed her the trailer. She's like, "This looks like that old Nicolas Cage movie." I'm like, "Well, first of all."
Actually.
But then.
Listen, bitch.
Right. And then as soon as I saw that big triangle, I'm like, okay, this is the Wicker Man thing. So, and I don't know. Then there's a bear, and I'm just like, wow. So it's not like, it wasn't fair that it had to enter my mind. I couldn't get away from it, but I don't know.
Well, and I think that it should, because it's one of those, you know, a lot of pagan imagery and a lot of in the sunlight. I mean, that was one of my first thoughts.
Yeah.
And when Sean brought up Cannibal Holocaust, and then I read about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I'm like, oh, okay, these are all valid, you know, points of reference.
But you know what else? I mean, what else is a great point of reference is The Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz is also very much there. She's Dorothy. You've got a scarecrow.
Right.
You've got a tin man in Josh. I mean, it's messed up. And then he's in a bear suit. Like, it could be a lion. I mean, I'm just saying. The Wizard of Oz.
Well, he was a coward, basically, because he was just kind of... He knew what he was doing to Josh. He knew what he was doing to Danny.
Yeah.
But he did it without trying to have any confrontation. So.
Yeah. Turns on his friends like that.
Exactly.
Well, we get a transition to the
end.
Yeah,
he absolutely.
Yeah. Anything else on Midsommar?
I just think, like I said, I think it's the best movie of this year. I don't see anything surpassing it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just it's an experience as much as it is a movie.
Yeah.
One of the first things I said to Sean was, "It's all downhill from here."
Bob wanted to give up movies, Jeff. He's just like, "I'm done with movies now."
I'll take over.
Will you?
He just doesn't want to watch Crawl.
Or Stuber.
Well, for Crawl, I read something the other day that was kind of upsetting, because I liked the trailer, and I love kind of big wet monster movies like that, but there's no critic screenings until the night before, and only in like two cities.
Right.
So
well, it's Alexander
that does
Asha,
not bode well.
It's Alexander Aja. It's already going to be a piece of shit. So let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah.
But final thoughts, Jeff?
Everybody should go see it. It's, I think, a spiritual sequel, or like not necessarily parallel, but like the light to Hereditary's dark. And if you liked Hereditary, you'll like this. If you loved Hereditary, you'll love this.
Yeah.
And if you didn't like them, you're stupid.
Zach, final thoughts?
Same thing. I hope everyone watches it, and I hope all the people that, like, did know a few people that didn't like Hereditary just because of, like, how odd the ending went. Mm-hmm. I hope they stay away from this and don't ruin this for me. I think more people need to give this one a shot.
But the whole thing we've been saying with Midsommar is just pay attention. It's not a weird ending when if you're watching the movie and noticing what's going on, and everybody's just like, it's Rosemary's Baby or Exorcist. I'm like, no, it's not. It's as much Rosemary's Baby as Midsommar is Wicker Man. You know, they're elements, sure, but they're different.
Well, when people say that, I think good,
right?
Because we don't have enough horror movies, and even though that. You know, no matter what Ari Aster says, this was a horror movie and so was Hereditary. But we don't have enough of those horror movies that take their time. The Exorcist took its time. Black Christmas took its time. You never, you know, you get to know these characters. Rosemary's Baby is a great horror movie because you never see the true horror until the last 20 minutes. And it's mostly her paranoia that's the horrifying part. There's not... You know, this, it doesn't have to be, you know, gore fest in your face, even though there are parts of it to that.
Right.
But it's one that will definitely hold up like Hereditary in multiple viewings. Like I said, I've been doing some Hereditary artwork this week, and I watched that movie probably 3 times in the last 2 weeks. And I find something new every single time.
Yep.
And I think that this will hold up that way as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me. Anytime.
And, of course, where can we get your art?
Oh, well, you can go to my website, which is jefflassiter.com, where you can follow the links to get T-shirts. I just put a Hereditary T-shirt on there this morning. You can follow me on Twitter at Deadsville, DeadsVille, or my Instagram is jefflassiter.com, all spelled out.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Cool.
Bye, everybody.